We're going to vary a little bit from our published agenda here by order and go directly to SJR 32 and have a public hearing on SJR 32. Staff introduce.
Thank you, Senator. SJR 32 urges the Department of Administrative Services, the State Court Administrator, the State Treasurer, Attorney General, Superintendent of Public Instruction, of the Bureau of Land and Industries to place automated external defibrillators in state buildings and public places under their purview. Also urges City Council, City County, and local governments to place these devices in government buildings and public places. As some background, cardiac arrest is primarily caused by ventricular defibrillation, which of the heart normal electric signals become erratic and cause the heart to cease pumping blood effectively. Devices, AED devices, attempt to restore the heart's normal rhythm by applying electrical shock, and there is a correlation that exists between the onset of this cardiac arrest and when defibrillation is given. Additionally, defibrillation needs to occur within 5 minutes of onset to have a reasonable expectation of determining survival being beneficial. These devices have been put on airplanes, office buildings, industrial plants, and other places over the last few years, and currently there's a study going on being conducted in North America to determine the difference in survival rates between the two groups when there is a machine present.
Okay, we have Brian Smith from the American Red Cross and Dick Wilkinson, American Red Cross, Oregon Trail Chapter.
Good afternoon. My name is Brian Smith. I'm an attorney in private practice, but I'm here today as a volunteer co-chair of the Red Cross State Legislative Committee, and also I'm a board member of the Red Cross chapter in Benton and Linn counties. We're here today in support of SJR 32. The bill declares legislative support for placement of automated external defibrillators in public buildings and public places to include state agencies that were mentioned as well as local governments. Red Cross and the American Heart Association believe that widespread availability of automated external defibrillators will help save lives of people who experience sudden cardiac arrest. And the Red Cross and the American Heart Association are co-requesters of this bill. This bill does not request any funding, but our goal really here is to raise awareness about the use of AEDs. Last session, the legislature passed a Good Samaritan law covering AED use by people who receive training that is provided by the American Red Cross and others. Now I'd like to introduce Dick Wilkinson from the Oregon Trail Chapter, who will provide more details about AEDs and their use.
Thank you. Senators, what we're really talking about here is the only life-saving treatment for over a 250,000 sudden cardiac arrest victims in this country each year.
Excuse me, could you identify yourself?
Sorry. I'm Dick Wilkinson. I'm with the Oregon Trail Chapter of the American Red Cross. This treatment to which I just referred is known as defibrillation and has been used to save lives by trained medical professionals for over 30 years. Today, technology has evolved to the point where non-professional responders, non-medically trained responders, can use the same treatment to save lives. And when I say non-medical, I mean people such as yourselves, people who are sitting in this room, people who are working in this building. All it takes is a device like this and a little bit of training. If I could, I'd like to just run through a brief demonstration of how this device is actually going to work. Once you have determined that your victim is unresponsive, has no circulation, you can't find a pulse, has no respiration, you can't detect any breathing, you would immediately send for someone to call 911, and if there was a defibrillator present, you would have someone get the defibrillator and bring it back as soon as they could. In the meantime, you would commence with CPR. Once the defibrillator arrives, you open it up, turn it on, and it will instruct you to connect electrodes. These are self-adhesive patches, which you would apply to the victim's bare chest. Proper positioning of them: one would go high right on the victim, one goes low left under the rib cage. If you can't remember that, there are diagrams on there that show you where they're to be placed. Once these are on, the unit will automatically sense.
Stand clear. Analyzing now. Stand clear.
That we have made a connection on the chest, and it's going to look at the
shock
heart rhythm.
Advised.
And see if the heart is in fact fibrillating. If it is, you will hear that announcement and this siren.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
We've just delivered a shock. We don't know if that shock worked
stand
or not.
Stand clear.
Allow me to turn this down.
Analyzing now. Stand clear.
We don't know if the shock worked because we can't see the heart. So the equipment will immediately go back,
shock advised,
reanalyze the heart. In this case, nothing has changed. So the unit's going to charge up again. It will only charge and only shock if the heart is in fact in fibrillation.
Push to shock.
Shock number two, okay? Again.
Stand clear.
We're going to analyze.
Analyzing now. Stand clear.
All the decisions are made by this device. You as the
no shock advised
provider only have to
check
listen
for pulse
to the instructions. After two shocks, this is advised, no shock advised, which means there's been a change. The heart is no longer fibrillating. We would hope
if
that
no
it has
pulse,
stopped
start CPR
and started back to a normal heartbeat. If it hasn't, we check the pulse. We can't detect a pulse. We're going to start CPR. This unit is going to count down internally for 60 seconds, and we'll come back and we'll do another analyzation. That basically is the scenario. Now, when this procedure, which I just did, is done in a hospital setting, the success rate, and please remember when I talk about success rate, I'm talking survival rate, the success rate is 90%. When this same procedure is done outside of a hospital setting, it's done in a home, in an office, a grocery store, on a golf course, the success rate is less than 10%. How do we go from saving 9 out of 10 victims in a hospital to losing 9 out of 10 victims outside of the hospital? The answer is the amount of time that transpires between the onset of the cardiac arrest and the initiation of the fibrillation, of the defibrillation. In a hospital, we're typically defibrillating in 2 to 3 minutes. The staff's there, they're trained, the equipment's there, there's lots of it. Outside of the hospital, one, the collapse has to be witnessed. Two, someone has to call 911. We have to await the arrival of 911. Once the paramedics get there, they still have to prep the victim before they shock. Now, if all those things I just mentioned take longer than 5 minutes, then the chance of survival for the victim has been greatly diminished. The reason for this is that without breathing to take oxygen in, without the circulation to send it to the vital body organs, neurological damage will commence within 2 to 3 minutes. If we do CPR in the victim, we can stretch that all the way out to about 4 to 6 minutes, but that's it, which is why 5 minutes has become the key number in doing this procedure. The only way to significantly reduce the high mortality rate of sudden cardiac arrest is to reduce the amount of time between the onset of the arrest and the initiation of defibrillation. And the way to accomplish this is to make AEDs available in public places. And that is why the American Red Cross and the American Heart Association have joined together and strongly encourages your support for this legislation. Any questions?
Senator Shields.
Yeah, it's fairly early probably in the process, but you gave us the statistics of 9 out of 10 in a hospital, 1 out of 10 when you have to go through the procedure of calling 911 and getting an ambulance. Have you got any statistics on places where these have been put in buildings enough to create a valid statistical sample, I suppose, and used by the public? Do you follow what I'm saying?
I do. There, there have been no what we would classify as truly scientific studies completed to date. There is one that is occurring right now. It started last fall in 40 locations in North America. One of those locations is in the Portland-Salem area. It's called the PAD study, Public Access to Defibrillation. That study is going to run 18 months and then have a 3-month evaluation period, probably before anything will be released on it. I can tell you in communities where these units have been put in police cars that the survival rates have gone up. In communities that have stressed CPR training and defibrillation training, we see the rates go up. The best study, and the one that we talk about, which is also still in progress, is known as the Las Vegas Casino Study, where they have put multiple units.
Where lots of people have heart attacks.
In multiple locations, have a high-risk population. And the other thing they have cameras all over the city.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So when the attack occurs or the cardiac arrest occurs, it's witnessed immediately.
Somebody just keeled over table 25.
Absolutely.
I was wondering if they
so
did that as
corny.
Loyally to winners as they did to losers.
Well, it's one way to get a customer for life, I guess.
Oh, man. It's getting deep in here.
We have two of them in the building.
As a result of that, they've seen, because they can witness the attack or witness the arrest, respond to it, one security officer will go and start CPR, one will get the nearest defibrillator. They're typically shocking within 2 minutes, and they're showing a survival rate of approaching 60%.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm interested in probably three questions, I guess. Number one is, what is the cost of these machines? Number two, what is the maintenance? And who's responsible and who has the liability for the maintenance?
The cost of the machine, depending on how it's equipped, I typically tell people that they're going to be looking at a budget figure of $3,000 to $4,000 per unit. As far as the maintenance, the machines are designed to be internally maintaining. They run diagnostic checks of themselves every 24 hours. They run a more involved check of themselves every 7 days. If during either of those checks anything shows up as being out of specifications, then the unit has a trouble light on it, which will come on. So the responsibility of the person who is maintaining the unit is basically to look at the unit on a daily basis and make sure that there aren't any status lights that are showing that need to be addressed. As far as liability for maintaining?
Well, not only for maintaining, but that could follow through that if there was an incident and the machine was not working, I would think who was responsible for that might have some liability.
Well, under Senate Bill 313 from October of 99, liability is exempt if certain requirements are met. One of those is the maintenance of the machine. And again, as lay responders, it is our choice whether we're going to respond or not. If you have been, and again, this is a legal issue that has been discussed but never really resolved, at least in the discussions I've been part of, is just because you have the ability, do you have the
obligation?
Yeah, the obligation or the requirement to respond. One of the points that's usually made is the victim, by definition, is dead. They have no pulse and they have no respiration. It's termed clinically dead. And my understanding from the legal side is that clinically dead is also legally dead.
Can I ask a question?
Senator Carter.
As a follow-up, is the cost of maintenance dealt within the structure of the fee structure already? You pay a certain amount of money a one-time payment for the machine? And if there is any ongoing maintenance, is it a part of that one-time payment?
There is a five-year warranty on most of the units that are out there. The maintenance costs on these are battery replacement. And depending on the model, the battery life, if the unit is not used, is typically between 3 and 5 years. So over a five-year period, you would assume one battery exchange. Also, the electrodes, because of the design, have an expiration date on them. They're usually about 2 years. So over a five-year period, you would be looking at 2.5, let's say, pair of electrodes. But the cost of the electrodes is under $40.
So I imagine, to your question, Senator, in terms of the cost of the if we were to have one here at the legislature, we would not have, you know, the keep the proper battery, keep up, and those kind of things. The obligation would then be on us at that point. I don't see any other obligation that would be a part of that, especially if the mechanism for correcting the action for maintenance is within the makeup of the machine itself. That doesn't seem a legal obligation.
If I could,
yes, Senator.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. My concern is that, in my experience running equipment, the worst thing for equipment is not to use it, and that's where you get electrolysis on the contacts, and you know, it's probably a bigger problem than, in this case, for sure, of overuse or anything, or even the batteries going dead. I would be more concerned that when it come to the emergency situation, that the contacts weren't clean and this type of thing.
There is a requirement, or actually the manufacturers put out a maintenance schedule with this for the maintainer or the operator to, on no less than a monthly basis, come out, turn the machine on, turn the device on, and let it come up to the point where it says connect electrodes. Now, on a true live unit, this unit is just a trainer. It's a demonstrator. On a true live unit, at that point, you would have to connect the electrodes to a human body to make the circuit connection and have it go forward. But simply by turning it on, it goes through a startup test every time you turn it on. So as part of the maintenance procedure, you would come in, you would take it out of the box, turn it on, and see if it came up to the point and said to you, connect electrodes. If it did, it's ready. And that's on a monthly basis.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator George.
You mentioned that some locations, police officers are actually carrying these with them. Are they then trained and certified then to go ahead and administer the shock?
They are.
Okay.
Generally, you'll find these in rural communities or smaller right. communities. If your primary response is fire and it's volunteer, you're never going to make the five-minute time period.
Mm-hmm.
So there are communities where the police officers carry them in the cruisers because they're typically going to be the initial response.
In those, a follow-up question, in those communities that in which that is legal, what kind of training requirements does it take for them to be certified to apply the shot?
Each state establishes its own training requirements based on whatever the state EMS is. As far as I know, nationally, the base requirements are that you have adult CPR and that you have the AED training. Now, the training that the Red Cross offers, we teach adult CPR in 3.5 hours. If we were to include training on this unit into that course, it would become a 4.5 hour course. So the training, as you can see, isn't that extensive because the machine is going to make all the decisions. You need to know how to apply the pads and how to pay attention, as well as some other instances, and you don't want to do this in water. You don't want to do this in a pool. If you're going to do this on a metal surface, it would be good to put something underneath the victim's chest to provide some insulation. And that's mainly for your protection as much as it is for the victims, because there could be some bleed off through conductivity. But that hasn't been a real problem.
Well, having gone through a few cardio versions, one of which was administered before I was not quite under, that thing kicks like a mule. And I wasn't going to volunteer to be your guinea pig up here.
Mr. Chair, I would like to mention that there are two in the building. There's one in visitor services and one down in facility services, and there are people in the building that are trained to use them. So.
Good. Thank you very much. Was there anyone else that wished to testify? I don't have anyone else written down. Public hearing, go into work session on SJR 32.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter.
I move Senate Joint Resolution. I move that we adopt Senate Joint Resolution 32.
With a due pass?
With a due pass recommendation, absolutely.
Senator Carter moves that we adopt Senate Joint Resolution 32 and send it to the Senate for the due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator
Messerly?
Aye.
Senator
Gill?
Aye.
Senator George?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Carter?
Aye.
Fisher?
Aye.
The motion carries. I wonder if I could shock Senator Shields and ask him to carry the bill.
I will give you an electrifying performance.
Oh man.
Thank goodness it's ready.
Thank you, Senator. I like it, one-upsmanship. Yeah,
tell me about this part of the this committee.
The motion is carried, and Senator Shields will carry the bill. I'll close the work session on SJR 32 and open a work session on Senate Bill 210.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter.
Can we, I'm sorry, I needed to have made a statement. Can we return back to Senate Bill 32?
You want to return to the work session or to the public hearing?
To the work session.
All right, I will close work session on Senate Bill 210, reopen the work session on Senate Joint Resolution 32.
Mr. Chairman, as an affiliated member of the board of the American Red Cross, I declare a potential conflict.
Okay. And you gave me an opportunity to do something I should have done also, and that is put two letters on the record that I slipped my mind to do here. One is from my own folks in Douglas County, from Sandra Ramirez, who is our executive director, and she sent a letter in support, and also Judy Leninger, the chair of the Oregon State Service Council of the American Red Cross, had sent a letter of support. So we'll introduce those into the record. And thank you, Senator Carter. Close the work session on Senate Joint Resolution 32 and open a work session on Senate Bill 210.
Senate Bill 210 requires the Department of Human Services or designated agency to clearly record the outcomes of a complaint investigation in the complaint file, prohibits foster care operators from discouraging or using intimidation to prevent individuals from complaints, and prohibits civil or criminal immunity for participants to knowingly or intentionally submit false complaints. In amendments adopted at the last meeting, it would also insert on page one of the printed bill after on line 21 after resident would be inserted or a person acting on the resident's behalf, and also on page two, line 38, restore the bracketed material.
Like restoring the bracketed material.
Thank you, staff. As was mentioned, we went ahead and adopted the dash two amendments. So I would entertain a motion to accept Senate Bill
210. Excuse me.
No, please.
Mr. Chairman, I would recommend that we send Senate Bill 210 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Senator George recommends that we send Senate Bill 210 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion or objection?
Yes, sir. I'd just like to put on the record that I am not comfortable with the restoring the bracketed material. I very strongly believe that all complaints in this arena or any place else should be signed. But in the interest of moving this bill, and it's my understanding that there's a House bill coming through that will address this issue, and so I will support the bill.
Thank you.
Just a comment. I still have the same problem that I've always had with this bill. I believe that when you have people in nursing homes who have, or in foster care homes or wherever, who have varying degrees of ability, that some of them will be intimidated, even though the bill is very clear and it says that foster home managers and staff are not allowed to intimidate anybody. I still think that there's a potential situation where people can be intimidated. Maybe an unintended consequence, but the way this bill is written, it's going to intimidate people, I believe, and keep them from coming forward, even if they have a legitimate complaint that ought to be brought forward. And for that reason, I'm still a no vote on this bill.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Carter.
I think I told you once before that I would not be supporting this bill because I personally and still am convinced that we have problems in our system, and further anonymity just send people underground. So I'll be a no vote on this bill.
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator.
Well, I'm anxious to support this bill because I believe that a person should be able to face their accuser. It obviously has significant protection for those who might report, and I believe, particularly with part of the bill that has been replaced, that it does provide significant protection. We've had a systematic process of undermining the Constitution of this country, and I think we need to be thoughtful about the fact that we have a constitutional obligation that we, in fact, be able to identify people who are making false claims. And here, of course, it does say that they may not, in fact, prohibit or discourage or intimidate in any way anyone or retaliate against them in these homes. And I think that's a plus to the protection of those residents. So,
thank you. Further?
Yes, Senator Mazur.
Mr. Chair, a comment that Senator George just made. This bill, as amended, they do not face their accuser. Were you aware of that?
Right. That's what I made reference to that. We're to the bracketing.
Further comments? Discussion? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Messerly.
Aye.
Senator Shields.
No.
Senator George.
Aye.
Vice Chair Carter.
No.
Chair Fisher.
Aye. The motion carries, and Senator Menace has agreed to carry this bill. Senator Menace. We will accept this bill as sent to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 210 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2101.
House Bill 2101 changes the name of the Office for Oregon Health Plan Policy Research to Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research. It removes the word plan from the name. As a little background, the Office for Oregon Health Plan Policy Research, or OHPPR, is the only state agency with the Oregon Health Plan in the name. However, this agency has no administrative or operational responsibility related to the state Medicaid program in the Oregon Health Plan. As a result, they do receive regular calls from people wanting to make application but cannot accept applications, so I refer them elsewhere. This will also clarify the agency's roles described in ORS 414021.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Santa, who is the head of this particular agency requesting this, give your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is John Sant. I'm the administrator of the Office for Oregon Health Plan Policy and Research. This is a pretty simple bill that takes one word out of our name, and that basically, as the summary you've just heard describes, is basically a customer service issue. We get around 200 calls a month, most of which are from people who believe that our agency is where they enroll in the Oregon Health Plan. They're frustrated when they learn that that's not the case. And we think that this would help clarify some of that confusion and make more sense to them when they are then directed in the right place. We want to emphasize that this will make no difference in terms of the customer service we do provide to the people who call us. We will continue to do our best to get those people satisfied and in the right place. And in particular, we are directed several calls from legislators, from constituents who have questions about the plan, including enrollment, and we're more than happy to continue to do that. We believe that the new name will more accurately reflect our office's purposes and will help some people to avoid an unnecessary call.
Okay. Now, I would guess if you are going to be relieved of answering 200 calls a month here that we'd expect to reduce your budget by a halftime equivalent. Or is it going to take that halftime equivalent to full time to get all your information changed and up to date and all your business cards changed?
Well, we have plenty to do that we can reallocate from a priority point of view.
I would put on the record for my colleague, Senator Shields, an unnamed lobbyist has indicated that he thinks the purpose of this bill was to knock some of the pee out of OPP.
That sounds like Shields, corny.
Further questions of our star witness here? I think you've done a good job.
Better quit while we're ahead.
Yes, right. Mr. Chairman, are we in work session on this?
We will go there directly. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2101 and open a work session on House Bill 2101.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter.
I move House Bill 2101 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Carter moves House Bill 2101 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Objection? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Messerly?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator George?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Carter? Aye.
Chair Fisher?
Aye. Motion carries. Do we have a volunteer carrier?
Mr. Chair, I'll take it. I have some photo of this one.
All right. I will yield to your, I may not repeat the lobbyist statement here for the record in the Senate floor, but maybe I'll leave that to Senator Shields and let him see how he can doctor that. Motion passes, and Senator Fisher will carry the bill. Close work session on House Bill 2101.
I thought you were carrying it.
And
offered.
You don't want him to carry the bill. He offered.
I thought he said I should have to carry it.
No,
he'll
whatever.
He'll
reopen that work session on House Bill 2101 and ask Senator Messerly to carry the bill. Thank you, Senator. Close work session on House Bill 2101 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 562.
Senate Bill 562 expands the authority of licensed dental hygienists to provide services under a limited access permit to individuals in certain facilities and to children and students in certain programs, schools, or training facilities. As some backgrounds, a dental hygienist primarily provides services such as root planning and cleaning, requiring the performance of services. Dental hygienists must graduate from an accredited dental hygiene program and be licensed by the state and supervised by a dentist. A limited access permit allows the hygienist to perform unsupervised dental hygiene services in nursing homes, adult foster homes, residential care, and other programs. Hygienists must receive a certain number of hours of supervised dental hygiene and practice to receive a permit. And undergo amount of training, number of hours of training in different areas of health and science to obtain the permit. We also have dash one amendments with this bill. Would you like me to read those, Senator?
Yes, please.
The 562-1 amendments on page one of the printed bill, line 16, would delete the word or. In line 17, delete the period and insert or. And then again, on line 17, it would be a statement, local correctional facilities and juvenile detention facilities, as those terms are defined in ORS 169.005, regional correctional facilities is defined in ORS 169.620, youth correctional facilities is defined in ORS 420.005. Youth care centers is defined in ORS 420.855. Department of Correction Institutions is defined in ORS 421.005. And then in line 18, after other, insert the word similar.
Okay. I'm looking for my copy of the amendments here, and I don't see them here. I'm probably overlooking them somewhere here in the process. Here we go. Thank you. Sometimes get mixed up between the files that I have in my office and the ones that I get when I arrive here at the committee. Now, am I under the assumption that these amendments
try to wake up a lobby
brought a consensus to this bill because we did have some opposition?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
A couple weeks ago, I had the guts to write a note to a lobbyist who was falling asleep in the back row, but I've never had the audacity to get a cup of coffee and take it to a lobbyist in the back row.
It's graciousness.
Thank you for that.
Thank you for the
demonstration of kindness, Senator George.
I'm wondering, Mr. Chair, if it would be appropriate if at certain times they return the favor to us.
Senator Messley, I vote yes.
I don't know. We're the ones that are putting them to sleep. I mean, you've got to think this through.
That's why I felt it was appropriate.
Senator, in response to your question, Mr. Paul Cosgrove is here, who's requested the amendment, and he might be able to speak to that.
Yeah, I'd be glad to have him coming.
We need to ask Mr. Cosgrove, does he want the bill or does he want to talk?
Not sure how deep in pay and payback I want to get here.
For the record, Paul Cosgrove, representing Oregon Dental Hygienists, we do want the bill. I won't talk except to say that, yes, we were the ones who brought the amendments, and I believe I can imagine the amendments in the testimony that was given at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I don't know that it removes. The only opposition I recall was Oregon Dental Association. Oregon Dental Association, the Board of Dentistry, supports it. I know they've known about these amendments, and they're not here, so it may have resolved at least some of their concerns. But I don't know that myself. I'd be glad to answer any other questions.
I didn't see anyone from that organization here, and so nor have I had them register for their complaint with me. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Public
hearing.
Okay. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 562 and go into a work session on Senate Bill 562.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Carter.
Move Senate Bill 562 to the floor.
We've got an amendment.
Dash one amendments to Senate Bill 562.
All right. Senator Carter moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 562. Is there further discussion? Objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter.
Moves Senate Bill 562 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Carter moves Senate Bill 562 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Objection? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Messerly.
Aye.
Senator Shields.
Aye.
Senator George.
Aye.
Senator Carter.
Aye.
I'd be glad to hear this if you wanted
to. Yes, I said aye. I was momentarily distracted by a volunteer carrier. It shocked me so much. I do vote aye. The motion carries. And Senator Shields has kindly volunteered to carry this. So it's passed. And I'll come to work session on Senate Bill 562 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 813.
Senate Bill 813 requires the Department of Human Services to pay or reimburse providers of ambulance services at least 80% of Medicare rate for ambulance services medical assistance recipients. There are various levels of ambulance services which are categorized by the type of emergency. Currently, the Office of Medical Assistance Program, or OMAP, oversees the program, reports that it pays for approximately 20,000 emergency and 5,500 non-emergency ambulance trips. OMAP reports that it pays providers a flat rate of $142 per trip for non-emergency and $166 per trip for emergency trips. Senator, we also have dash one and dash two amendments. Would you like me to read those?
Yes.
Dash one amendments, 813-1, in line five of the printed bill, it would delete 80% of. The dash two amendments in line five of the printed bill, delete ORS 642.025 and insert ORS 682.025.
Well, what's the effects of those amendments?
Well, the effects of them, one of them, the second amendment, was to get the right number.
Okay.
It put in the wrong number for the ORS. And the other one, I think I'm going to ask Sean Baird from the Oregon Ambulance Association and Ted Farr, Oregon Fire Medical, is it?
Yes, sir.
From Clackamas, to discuss this issue. Go ahead, gentlemen.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ted Farr. I'm a paramedic with the fire department in Salem and represent the Oregon Fire Medical Administrators Association. I live in Clackamas County. The Medicare rate, when the bill was established in legislative council, there was an error in the draft. The reason for the error is that the Medicare rate is determined for an ambulance service by what Medicare arrives at and is referred to as the allowable amount. That allowable amount is determined in a rather complex formula, but is individual to each agency. The dollar amounts referred to in the legislation are based on a range of those allowable amounts, from a low of $270 to a high of $550, depending on the ambulance company allowable amounts. Currently, Medicare pays 80% of the allowable amount, so the Medicare rate, the amount of money they pay, is actually 80% of their allowable. We intended with the bill to accomplish the payment at the Medicare rate, not in reference to the allowable.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Carter.
I was so very pleased. If there was ever a time when public policy comes to the great discretion of resolving debate and people working together, I think that this association has done, and I want to commend all the persons involved with making this come to a fruitful and productive outcome. Because no matter how much we want to serve the people in terms of medical service, we have to consider holistic approach to how we provide that, and the ambulance people. I've had this argument since I think it first came to our attention, 1987 was?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can remember, I'm sure 87, 88, somewhere
yeah,
in there.
Yeah, something like that. And so this has been a long time. And so I'm really very, very pleased that as an assembly of the people, that we have found an amicable resolution, even though it's not totally productive for these people because they are not getting the benefits of all the years they have been outside of the system of consideration. But at least we have made a step in the right direction.
Thank you.
Thanks, Senator Carter. Mr. Baird, did you wish to
the Ambulance Association is supportive of the amendments.
Well, the governor's office not put on record because that's why I held it up. They came and told me to go ahead and send this bill down. So we're here prepared, I believe, to do that today. And thank you very much for coming. And
thank you.
Great. Thank you.
I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 813 and open a work session on Senate Bill 813.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter.
I move the dash one and two amendments to Senate Bill 813.
Senator Carter has moved the dash one and dash two amendments on Senate Bill 813. Further discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter.
I'd like to move Senate Bill 813 to the Committee on Ways and Means.
You wish to have attached a due pass to that?
Yes, I would like an attached to that be a due pass recommendation by this committee.
Okay. Senator Carter has moved that we send this bill to the the Ways and Means Committee, and that we recommend a due pass on this bill. So is there further discussion, objections? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll here for us?
Senator
Nestle? Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Dorr?
Aye.
Senator Carter?
Aye.
Chair Fisher?
Aye. The motion carries. We don't need a carrier for this, so Senate Bill 813 will be on its way. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 813, and Senator Shields has a comment.
Well, I have a question, and I have to preface this by saying that I'm really in territory that I'm very unfamiliar with, and so I'm just asking a question at this point. I do feel strongly about Senate Bill 210, and I was wondering if it would be appropriate to maybe try to, I don't know how you do this, because I've never done it before, but to develop an improvement on the bill and submit it as a minority report. Is that possible? I don't understand.
There's always a minority report possibility, and those have to be declared by a certain time. I think, isn't it 24 hours or something after the
yes.
committee meeting? Perhaps
I wasn't clear
the staff
about that.
Could,
by 5 o'clock today, Mr. Chairman, this is the weekend.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether that extends past the weekend or whether it just
well,
it hurries the process up for the day, but I think it has to be a written
Yes, Senator.
Notice, and I believe there's you have to have one other person.
According to what I understand the rules, it has to be at least two people, and they would have had to dissent on the vote.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chairman, let me just say this. I respect very much your work in this arena over the years. And a minority report for me would be better than just a blanket no, because it shows that we tried to work things out, and in giving respect to your work over the years, I would feel much more comfortable with that than just having a blanket no statement, because I think it is an issue of concern, and it is an issue of public policy, and somewhere within where this bill is and another space where I would like to be in terms of being a part of the solution as opposed to a part of the problem would give me a way to make a statement here also. So I'd be more than glad to join the senator from Southeast Portland on this issue.
Well, I have absolutely no axe to grind on that committee-wise. You certainly have every right to exercise your options, and that's part of our process, and I wouldn't want in any way to disturb our process or try to put any pressure on someone to do something different than what they wish to do. So I would certainly recommend that if the staff here doesn't feel comfortable in doing and helping and guiding you through it, then I would recommend that you see the Secretary of the Senate, because I know that she'll know the proper routine. I've never been through one of those myself, so I've never
actually, Mr. Chair,
the routine 100%. I've read it a couple of different times, but I actually haven't done it.
Right. Well, actually, what he needs to do, and I'm very proud of Senator Shields, because I never like blindsiding my chair, and to declare it here rather than just to file it through the process by 5 o'clock p.m. No, Mr. Chairman, I feel very strong as a matter of ethics that it happens. So what he needs to do, he has announced it here, then he goes to the Secretary of the Senate and announces the minority report, and then he prepares with our administrator to come back with what the minority report is going to look like in terms of the variation on the theme.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate the courtesies. However, I want to make it very, very plain here that my ego doesn't demand that you necessarily... I mean, you have your rights, and I don't hold it against anybody one way or the other. So feel free to conduct yourselves in a manner that you wish to here without having to worry about the chairs being blindsided or something like that. I, I don't have too much worries about that type of thing.
Mr. Chairman, I think
But I would also note that I was trying to get you out of here as quick as I could on Friday.
On Friday, you know that.
We can make it in another minute.
You're now volunteering to stay and help me do this.
No, he's going to do it, Mr. Chair.
Senator Messerly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I respect our colleagues here and their opinion. I'm a little bit troubled, though, that we didn't see an amendment that we all could have taken a look at and maybe endorsed. I don't know. And so, you know, I'm not trying to say that I don't respect what they're going to do, but I think it probably would have been easier and cleaner if we could have, if we had voted down the amendment, then I would understand exactly what we're doing.
Like I said, I'm unclear myself because I haven't done this before, but like the good senator from North Portland said, it'll be a variation on the theme. And the variation would have to do with trying to find some way to potentially be less intimidating toward especially the lowest end of the workforce if they actually see some kind of violation.
Chief, any further?
No.
Everyone have a nice weekend. Thanks for coming, and we're out of here in 1 hour.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman,